This week on Making Contact.
The reason why people join your cause is not something that you readily know when they decide to be part of it, but something that you discover as you go along.
What does it mean to be an ally in a political movement? From white Americans in the civil rights era to Israelis in Palestine to Latino Americans working with the undocumented. How does one work to support another's struggle?
Actually, what we need you as white people to do is to step up and you tell them as white people why racism is a problem for white people. That's the work that you can do for me to be a great ally in that moment.
On this edition, from Mississippi to Zimbabwe, a roundtable discussion on the do's and don'ts of how to be an effective ally. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Today, we're going to talk about what it means to be an ally in a struggle for justice. It's something that's kind of hard to define, but some classic examples might be a white American in the U.S. civil rights struggle or a white South African working to end apartheid. In general, we're talking about people who wouldn't gain directly from the struggle they're getting involved in. Joining me to talk about this are four people who all work in partnership with allies in a number of different movements for social justice. So let's start off by meeting everyone. Please introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, what kind of issues you work on as an organizer, and who your allies are, or maybe you are an ally yourself.
My name is Lihi Rothschild. I live in Tel Aviv, Israel, Palestine, as a white Israeli considered Jewish by the state. I am an ally to Palestinians that I'm working with, as well as refugees and work migrants. At the same time, as a woman and as a bisexual woman, I have allies that are both men and heterosexuals.
My name is Ingrid Cruz. I live in the state of Mississippi in the United States, and I mostly work on immigration issues. In that issue, I consider myself to be an ally to undocumented immigrants, but as a whole, working on racial justice issues, I'm kind of the one that is the person of color and might have allies.
My name is DJ Hudson. I hail from Nashville, Tennessee, where majority of the organizing and the activist work that I do is around racial and economic justice. Most of the people who I end up working with as allies are white Southerners or white Americans. However, also as a member of the LGBT community, I often work with straight allies as well as allies from religious communities.
Hello, my name is Rumbidzai Dube. I am a human rights lawyer from Zimbabwe. I work on a lot of human rights issues, but one of the main ones I work on is ending organized violence and torture, with a specific focus on women victims of violence in Zimbabwe. And for this, we have a number of allies from many different countries, including South Africa, the US, Canada, who have grown an interest in the issue of sexual violence against women, the use of rape against women, human rights defenders, and women activists in general.
Okay, I'm going to bring someone else into this conversation via a pre-recorded interview. Mary King was heavily involved in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, back in the early 1960s. It was a group that organized many successful actions in the American South around freedom and equality for Black Americans. She's also a professor at the University of Peace and has studied nonviolent struggles around the world. Here's what Mary King had to say when I asked her about her experience and the concept of working as an ally in a struggle for justice.
By and large, the white staff persons were very, very much aware of the fact that they were there to play a particular role, either to help raise money or for communications or to organize the solidarity groups that we had in other cities, Princeton, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, LA, and so on. We had particular roles to play. And we hadn't come there because we were looking for the glamour of leadership. There was another angle that I need to mention, which is that within SNCC, and this is due to Ella Baker's influence very profoundly, we saw ourselves as trying to awaken and elicit leadership from people who were gifted natural leaders and to build up the leadership from the black community. Ms. Baker would talk with us about this constantly, that we are not here to become leaders ourselves. And she would say, you have to have a sense of your own worth and a strong sense of security to realize that you should forego the glamour of being a leader, help someone else to become a leader. And I think it made us a stronger movement that we were an interracial movement, because what it signified is that the stakes were much larger than just the self-interests of those who were involved. It was a statement in and of itself. The interracial nature of the movement was a statement that what is at stake is the character of the United States of America. So I think that everyone gained as a result of it being interracial. We have been meeting together now with a number of people who have participated in movements in which the individuals who stand to gain from it or are the sufferers of oppression have been working side by side with those who arguably could be said to be representatives of the oppressor group. This sounds very detached and social science-y, but I think you know what I mean. It's a good thing to have representatives from the oppressor community and the oppressed working together.
So that was Mary King, who used to work with SNCC and also a professor at the University of Peace. Anybody have thoughts or reactions to that and how those ideas might relate to your own work?
I certainly do. What she said about self-awareness and the awareness of who you are and what you come to do in a movement, I think has a lot to bring to bear in the role of allies in a movement. In the American South and in movements for racial justice, where race and racism is still something that's really touchy and problematic, one of the things that I've found that I've experienced is, contrary to popular belief, what most people assume, the majority of the racism, of the ugly words, of the exclusionary practices, of the discriminatory comments and actions that I've ever experienced in my life have come from within movements. They have come from my white allies or non-black allies within the movement. I think that part of why that happens is a lack of this self-awareness within movements. One of the things that I find myself doing way more than I wish I had to is having conversations with white allies about how, while yes, you might be participating in a movement for the freedom and advancement of black people or of Latinas and Latinos or of poor people, you can still actually be racist. Just because you are on our side does not mean that you have unlearned all the things that society has taught you. And also too, on that same token, being a recipient of white privilege is not something that you chose. And so the opposite response, where people, rather than ignore their white privilege and believe that they are automatically the best ally ever, some people like just drown themselves in white guilt. And so they wake up to their privilege and say, oh my God, you know, this body that I live in, I get all these free passes. It's terrible. It's horrible. I hate, you know, myself and my family and my heritage and da da da. And they try and reject as much about themselves as possible, which is equally destructive. Again, this self-awareness, knowing that you didn't choose to be white, you didn't choose to be straight, you didn't choose to be whatever it is that you are that gives you privilege the vast majority of the time, and therefore being guilty for it is just as unnecessary as wielding it again over and against other people.
Yeah, I wanted to add to what DJ said, which really resonated with me, because, you know, we both live in the South, really close to each other. And so living in Mississippi, working in the immigration movement, I feel like I have two identities. One, I'm an ally to undocumented immigrants. It has to do with a piece of paper and having a social security number, which gives you a lot of access to different things in the U.S. But being a Latina, I'm still, you know, not white. I'm also not African-American. I'm not Native American, you know. So it's a little bit more of a complicated conversation, in which there are times in which I myself have white allies, and then there are times when I have to negotiate what it means to be an ally to someone that's more oppressed than me, when I'm still not in the white privilege bracket. And I just wanted to add another thing to what DJ said about white privilege, is I had a discussion with someone who was a white ally to immigration movements and also civil rights movements. Someone who was old enough to be there, he was about 72, and he just looks at me, taps me on the shoulder, and says, you know, you and I are the same. Now, I recognize you don't have to guilt trip yourself over being white. Nobody chose that. But you also can't say that we're the same, that everyone is the same, because at the end of the day, you know, I'm the one that can't take off this skin. But you can go home and put away the movement when you're at home. You don't have to think about, wow, is the police just going to come raid my house all of a sudden for no reason? You don't have to think about, if I'm driving, who's the police going to stop? You know, the white ally or me or someone who's African-American or looks different. So I think that along with also just being conscientious, just recognizing we're not on an equal playing field.
Okay, I'm going to move in a sort of different direction from the rest of you guys. And one of the things that I would say has been a push factor in our efforts to try and establish a network of allies in the issue of violence-free elections has been a recognition that the issue of violence against women in the context of elections is not necessarily just our issue as Zimbabwean women. This is not just a regional issue, it's a global issue. And so in building a network of allies, it allows the movement and the struggle itself to become a stronger voice, to resonate with a lot of other people who can push in certain areas that we cannot reach, and to push the struggle forward in a way that we would not be able to. But also, I just wanted to point out that sometimes some of the people that we would ordinarily think would be allies are not necessarily allies in the sense that we would want them to. And this resonates with one of the things that DJ said about people who are already part of the movement and are sort of allies. For instance, in her case, it's mostly white people who are in the same struggle for equality and an end to racial segregation. In my case, I would have it as mainstream civil society, which is largely male dominated. You would assume that because these people are already working on human rights, they would automatically understand the struggle for women to have violence-free elections, for women to be free from rape and all the other forms of sexual violence. But half the time, the patronizing attitude that you talked about, Ingrid, of people trying to say, oh, but we are all fighting for human rights, like we are all the same. Why are you trying to make your issue sound more special? Comes out a lot. So it's a little difficult sometimes because the people that you really want to be the allies don't necessarily understand where your struggle is going and why you need them to be allies and why they should be. And I don't know.
In many cases, it's very, very painful because it's so disappointing. Because you're like, okay, these people are standing there with me week after week, chanting slogans and getting tear gas for that matter, like when I'm speaking about the men in my movement. We've been working together for years, and they're all about human rights, and they're all about equality for and justice for Palestinians. But when it comes to women, they can't understand why, as men, they have privilege, why, as men, they have to take a step back in conversation and allow women to participate, or why certain things that they're saying are silencing, or when they're raising their voice, it's intimidating, or we want to have a sexual harassment-free environment to work in.
Yeah, and for me, what it means to for someone to be an ally is for them, first of all, to just step into my shoes, see what it is that I'm fighting against every single day. Because a lot of times, men just don't understand why women make a lot of noise about inequality. And as DJ was saying, a lot of white people who not understand why black people or Latinos in America would make a lot of noise about inequality, or why a Palestinian living in Israel would make a lot of noise about inequality. Some people are just blind to the realities of this world. And the first thing that someone would need to do for them to actually understand why we're fighting the things we're fighting against is to just live what we live through just for a single day. And see the kind of horrors that people have to live with, the kind of difficulties that people have to put up with. And then after doing that, to empathize, because that's what it takes for someone to actually be an ally. You have to understand what I'm going through and feel for me the same way that I would feel for you if you were in my shoes and I wasn't yours. And then to take action, to assist. And it's not necessarily usurping my role in the struggle. As an ally, your role is not to tell me what to do. Donors come into a community that is already fighting for social justice, and they determine what it is that you fight for. They try to influence what you focus on, the way in which you produce the results, who you target as part of their
requirements for reporting and things like that. And I find that to be one of the most annoying things that has happened to the struggle for human rights and even for the work that I do, fighting against sexual violence. In the context of elections, you have to have bread and butter on your table. And for you to have that, you have to seek assistance from other people. But the problem is that they come as allies, and in the end, they want to tell you what to do.
So we've heard a lot about the problem from different perspectives. I'm wondering if any of you have examples of times when this arose, when somebody was trying to get involved as an ally, but was doing it the wrong way. How do you handle those? And I'm especially interested in cases where you feel like you successfully dealt with it and you were able to bring that person or people into the fold.
I can think of two instances in which, now these are not very big things, but two instances in which this was dealt with successfully. And it's just a very small group dynamic. So I have a friend. She was a student at UCLA. And whenever she would have meetings, you know, with her group, she would always keep account of how many people spoke in the room. She would kind of take a mental note of about, let's say, how many men are there, how many women, you know, if there's anybody that's queer or undocumented. I mean, if she knew those things, you know. And so sometimes during a meeting, especially strategic planning meetings, she would say, okay, everyone, we need to hear from everyone. There are 7 women in the room and 4 men. All of the men have spoken and only 3 women have spoken. And things as simple as just keeping count of those things. I was in Washington, D.C. in February for this really intense training having to deal with immigration issues. I confronted the national executive director of the entire organization. I basically told him, look, what I notice in our conversation is that whenever you speak, I let you speak your full sentences. So I said, how about this? I want to speak in full sentences too. We're having a lot of miscommunication because you're assuming that you know what I'm going to say before I say it. Then you're interrupting me. So this is really skewing the conversation into like a really bad place only because I can't speak in full sentences. So he apologized for that. These are these tiny socialized norms that I've noticed in different countries. And sometimes it just takes that one-to-one interaction and pointing it out. And if that person hates you, well, too bad. But they'll learn a lesson.
That is another reason why having these conversations are so difficult, because very often when you try to challenge someone on their privilege or on their racism or on their sexism or on their homophobia, they can easily wrap up what they're doing in some other language. They can make it an issue of organization and say that, you know, well, it's my job to do X, Y, and Z, and so I'm not being sexist, I'm just being a leader, those sorts of things. And sometimes it's true that people don't even realize that they are disguising the real issue.
One thing that I've noted is that in many cases, actually, they try to frame it as a personal problem, but not as a personal in the level of they being wrong, but actually as a personal thing of, oh, you just don't like me, or
you're being too sensitive.
Yeah, or we have problem communicating with one another. You misunderstood. Why are you so sensitive? Why do you jump whenever somebody raises their voice? If you're intimidated, then it's your problem. If you don't speak out in a meeting, it's your problem. It's not anybody's fault. And it's not that I'm taking too much space. It's just that you're not taking enough space, and et cetera, et cetera. These are excuses that constantly come up. But I actually wanted to share another positive story, which was... I had a very traumatizing experience in a demonstration in which I was sexually assaulted when I was like left alone and lost in an unfamiliar city. And the week after that, we had a group meeting to discuss that as part of Anarchist Against the Wall. And the amazing thing about that meeting was that women spoke one by one by one about those violent experiences that they've had, those sexually violent experiences, and the men remained silent. And more than that, the men asked us to keep on talking, and they like said, we just want to sit and listen. And for a whole meeting, men just sat and listened. And it was something that I experienced just this one time in my life. And for once, I think that these men actually got the hang of our experiences, because they were absolutely shocked and amazed when they left the meeting. But also, for once, women in the group actually got a space in which they could fully express themselves. And the reason that so many experiences that were left unspoken came up in this meeting is that for the first time, we had space. We had a place in which we could talk. And while I'm not 100% happy with many development that happened afterwards, at least out of this meeting, I came out feeling very, very empowered and felt like I truly had some men allies.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a roundtable discussion held at the Narco News School of Authentic Journalism in Mexico in April 2013, featuring Daria Hudson, Rumbidzai Dube, Leahy Rothschild, and Ingrid Cruz. We pick back up with Leahy Rothschild.
One of the dilemmas that I face as an ally in the Palestinian struggle is to what extent do I draw attention to myself and to, for that matter, the violence that I experience in the struggle from my own country. Because as a white Israeli, every violent act, every form of repression that is directed towards me gets far more attention than those things when they happen to Palestinians. When I get arrested, when I get beaten up, when I get interrogated by the secret police or have my house raided, that makes it to the news, that's getting reported. But in most cases, when it happens to a Palestinian, and for many of them it's a daily occurrence, it's no news. And there is this question of how much space do I take with these experiences? How public do I go with them? Because on one hand, it draws attention to the Palestinian struggle. It exposes for many people the way the Israeli government is treating people who support the Palestinian cause and enhance also the way the Israeli government is treating Palestinians. And at the same time, it still feels somewhat disturbing that people are so shocked and dismayed. What, they have tortured you when you were arrested? But they fail to see the fact that this happens every day in military courts.
One of my good friends and fellow organizers and ministers back in Nashville once said something really profound. He said that racism in America did not start to change until white people were in rooms full of white people talking about why racism was a problem for white people. And an instance where I had to push back on someone was in a group of people who I was on a listserv with, were talking back and forth about this KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, was having a rally, and all these white supremacists were coming together. And one white guy, sent an email out saying, you know, what are the contact information of different peoples of colors group? What are contact information for like Jewish associations and the NAACP and Latino organizations so that we can get them here? And my response was, actually, none of us want to show up. These people have been calling us out of our names and have been like hurting us, killing us, and intimidating us and terrorizing us for generations. Actually, what we need you as white people to do is to step up and you go face them. You tell them as white people why racism is a problem for white people, because I am not about to put myself in a situation to be demeaned and demoralized, because that's what they want, is for me to come out and to face them. I'm not giving them that. You go do it. Actually, that's the work that you can do for me to be a great ally in that moment. And he hadn't thought about it that way. But the problem is that oftentimes the responsibility for fighting against oppression falls to those oppressed groups.
I agree with you. I think that one of my duties is, as someone who's at least stated identified as Jew, is to go and say that the struggle for Palestine is not struggle against Jewish people. It's not, there's nothing anti-Semitic in demanding equality for Palestinians. From the place that I come from, as an Israeli Jew, my words get greater validation.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you, because even in the struggle for gender equality, I would assume that if a man were to stand and say, simply because we're struggling for women to have the same rights that we as men already have, it doesn't mean that we're diminishing
our position as men. We are just elevating women from where they are right now, which is like in a really bad place. That would be received in a more open way by other men than if it's a woman who is trying to say the same thing.
In terms of a response to what the three of you have said, it made me think of something that I read once in a feminist publication talking about how men who want to be feminists don't need to assume roles of leadership in the feminist movement. Instead, they take the spaces where they know they're privileged and make it safe for women there. And I think that that's kind of the way that you're an ally. Like for me, I mean, it's a multicultural country. Anytime you hear a racist remark against anybody or something that demeans everyone, then if you're really a true person of conscience, that's your time to try to educate the person in a peaceful way, or if you're able to. When you are an ally, that's all you do. Make it all spaces safe for those people.
And some concrete things that allies can do. One thing is that discomfort is actually an opportunity for change. A lot of people, especially who come from privileged societies like the United States, really back away from discomfort of all kinds, and they avoid it at any possible chance. And part of learning how to be an ally is being able to face and to sit with discomfort and being able to be made uncomfortable, to be made vulnerable, and to be made hurt, and not run from that, but to learn from that experience and to say, you know what, actually, I'm feeling really uncomfortable. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling afraid. I'm feeling attacked. Where is that coming from? And when you follow that line of where is that feeling of discomfort coming from, that's where you learn where your privilege lies, and that's where you learn where to change. Also, too, becoming comfortable with discomfort is another tool to help other people who also share your privilege to understand their own privilege. So just as Ingrid said, when racist comments are made, instead of laughing it off, or instead of just saying, oh, ha, 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 making a joke to try and still keep that level of comfort with that person, be very firm and clear. Hey, dude, that was not cool. Or actually, that's not funny. I find that offensive. And the person probably will be like, but you're not Mexican or you're not Black. And it's like, I don't care. It's not funny. It's not cool. Don't say it in front of me. And then if they want to have a discussion about it, talk about it then. If not, then carry on. But don't condone something by your silence or by your laughter or by acquiescing to somebody else's discomfort. Mm-hmm. Sit with that discomfort and learn from it and help other people do the same.
And I'll go back to the point I mentioned earlier on empathy. If you're feeling intimidated as someone who wants to be an ally, just imagine how that particular group has been feeling all along, being the small anthill in the middle of a whole group of big hills that are casting their shadows on those people. So if you just put yourself in the shoes of those people and how intimidated they must have been initially when they decided to take a stand, then I suppose that can make you feel a whole lot better about joining them and knowing that these are people who understand exactly what you're going through.
I've been speaking with Daria Hudson, Leahy Rothschild, Rumbizai Dube, and Ingrid Cruz. We will link to their organizations and others you heard about during today's discussion on our website, radioproject.org. Thanks, everyone, for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from a discussion recorded at the 2013 Narco News School of Authentic Journalism. To hear the full unedited version, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.